Welcome to Music for Life, exploring the purpose and value of music to humanity's enrichment. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is an instrumental movement from Carl Orff's choral masterpiece, Carmina Burana, performed by Leonard Slatkin and the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra. This movement is titled Dance, and today on Music for Life, we are going to explore the vast array of music inspired by the spirit and art of dance. From instrumental music based on specific dance meters, to vocal music about dancing, and from pieces intended to be danced to on stage, to music intended to be danced to in the imagination. In our Sounds of Scripture segment, we will show how the art form of dance influenced the musical output of biblical times. And for our Classroom Corner segment, we will show the many advantages to incorporating movement in music education. All this and more on a packed episode of Music for Life today, titled Moving Music. For a few summers, I had the opportunity to travel away from home and my usual piano teacher to study piano with the great Ray Hansen. I'll never forget all the stories he would tell. Some he would tell for historical value, and some were to make a point to back up what he was teaching me musically or pianistically. He was a student of the piano legend Harold Bauer. Harold Bauer was an anomaly in the piano world because he started as a violinist and didn't take up the piano until later in life, about age 20. And not only that, he was basically self-taught as a pianist and became a formidable force in the piano world. The story Mr. Hansen would always tell me about Harold Bauer is how he learned his piano technique from a ballerina. Bauer had told the dancer that he learned how to move his fingers on the keys by watching the way her legs, feet, and her entire frame would move across the stage gracefully. Since I was such an impressionable teenager, I knew I'd never forget that story. And so when someone bought me the book, The Great Pianists, which I have right here, I was pleased to find Harold Bauer and his dancer muse mentioned in this volume. Of course, I felt honored that I had heard the story from someone who had had firsthand experience with Bauer himself. But this is what the book says. Apparently, he did have a few lessons from an aunt when he was a child. Others mention lessons from a pianist named Derek Cook. In an article he wrote for the Musical Quarterly, Bauer said that the greatest influence on his piano playing was the dancer Isadora Duncan. He watched her and was struck by the way she translated music into motion. Bauer wondered if he could reverse the process, translating motion into music, and he worked out a series of muscular movements that enabled him to overcome a deficient technique. And that's just a remarkable story of a dancer impacting a musician. And that's a bit of a rare example in some respects, but what's not rare is how the art of dance has impacted musical compositions throughout history. It's an overwhelming amount of music, actually, but we're going to touch on some amazing highlights today. First, to set up this subject, let's begin with our Sounds of Scripture segment, where we survey the Bible's many references to music for a longer sweeping historical perspective on our episode's theme. Just as dance has influenced the music of recent history, the same would be true of biblical times. Music would have been composed and performed in some cases to accompany dance, or even would have been influenced by the spirit of dance. At least 20 verses in the King James Version of the Bible refer to dancing, and wherever there is dancing, we know there would have to be music. Two of those verses about dancing can be found in the last two Psalms, which charges the reader to use dance in praise of God and His name. Several verses contrast dancing with mourning. The famous verse in Ecclesiastes 3:4 says there's a time to weep, and a time to laugh, a time to mourn, and a time to dance. A verse in Lamentations references a people's dance being turned into mourning. In the opposite direction, King David said in Psalm 30, verse 11, that God turned his mourning into dancing. Similarly, Jeremiah 31 verse 13 quotes God as saying, "I will turn their mourning into joy," after saying that the virgin shall rejoice in the dance, both young men and old together. So according to the Bible, dancing is for everyone, not just for one gender or age group. The Bible's first chronological reference to dancing occurs in Exodus 15 at the shores of the Red Sea. Miriam, the sister of Moses and Aaron, is dancing with timbrels. This passage connects this percussion instrument, the Hebrew tof, which we discussed in a previous episode, with the art of dancing, which was a common pairing in ancient times. We see this connection between the tof and dancing in Judges 11:34, when Jephthah's daughter came out to meet him with timbrels and with dances. We also see this instrument paired with dancing later in Jeremiah 31 verse 4, which reads, "Again I will build you, and you shall be built, O virgin of Israel. You shall again be adorned with your tabrets, and shall go forth in the dances of them that make merry." Psalm 68 verse 25 also implies this same pairing of young ladies playing the timbrels with the art of dancing. But back to the Exodus 15 mention of the dancing performed by Miriam and the women of Israel. The Hebrew word for dances here implies a round dance or a whirling dance of some sort. Alfred Sendri writes in his book, Music in Ancient Israel, "The union of both arts, singing and dancing, is here by no means a fortuitous occurrence. It is a typical example of a ritual song for dancing." So not only is dancing usually mentioned along with music, the biblical record commonly favors the combination of vocal music along with dancing. The next biblical reference to dancing is cast in a negative light, as well as the music that accompanied it, music which was mistaken for the sounds of war, as Moses was coming down from Mount Sinai in Exodus 32 to find the Israelites worshiping a golden calf. Verse 19 reads, "And it came to pass, as soon as he came near into the camp, that he saw the calf and the dancing." So the visual element of this offense was found in both the idol as well as the kind of dancing Moses saw. Alfred Sendri contrasts this dance with Miriam's dance on the shores of the Red Sea. He says the biblical narrator dilates intentionally upon the unrestrained character of this dance around the calf in order to emphasize the sacrilege of idolatry. He poses the idea that this dance was likely very much like the priests of Baal leaping around the altar in front of Elijah and all Israel when they were cutting themselves and wailing, and that can be found in 1 Kings chapter 18. Since the calf represented one of the main pagan deities of the Egyptian culture, the Israelites certainly would have learned what the Bible characterizes as a misuse of song and dance from this pagan influence. The next reference to dancing has already been mentioned, that of Jephthah's daughter in Judges 11. The book of Judges contains a few more references to dancing, though. The phrase in Judges 16:25, where the Philistines asked Samson to make us sport, may imply that they wanted Samson to dance for them. Then in Judges 21, verses 26 and 23, there is an explicit reference to dancing of the daughters of Shiloh and the wives of the children of Benjamin, respectively. Moving ahead in the biblical record, in the 1 Samuel 21 account of David's time in Gath while he was fleeing for his life, we pick up this remarkable fact about Israel's performing arts. It says, "And David arose and fled that day for fear of Saul, and went to Achish the king of Gath. And the servants of Achish said unto him, Is not this David the king of the land? Did they not sing one to another of him in dances, saying, Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s? Verses 10 and 11. The king of Gath is told not only the lyrics of the song, he's told how it was sung one to another, and that it was performed in dances. We can see the same question asked later by the Philistines in 1 Samuel 29:5. This song and dance was known a great distance away from where it was performed, which is a remarkable occurrence for ancient times, long before the days of iTunes and YouTube. A well-known biblical reference to dance is found when King David is bringing the Ark of the Covenant back to Jerusalem. In this account, David himself is dancing to the jubilant music of the procession. We see this through the eyes of his wife, Michal, who is looking out a window and sees David, quote, dancing and playing, unquote. And that's found in 1 Chronicles 15:29. As we discussed in a previous episode, where we showed the similarities between this dance and the Celtic dancing arts, the word for dancing is not the typical Hebrew word used to describe dancing in the Bible. It refers to children dancing or the skipping or springing of animals. In fact, the King James translators use this word to describe the dance of calves in Job 21:11 and the dance of goats in Isaiah 13:21. The parallel account in 2 Samuel 6:14 16 says David was leaping and dancing. There is another unique Hebrew word for dancing, meaning whirling. It is only used here to describe David, along with the word for leaping, which means to be light, agile, and to jump as a gazelle. David not only danced, but apparently established a new style in this celebratory moment. In the New Testament, Jesus used the combination of music and dancing as a simile for the current generation's refusal to heed his message. In Matthew 11, 16-17, he said, "It is like unto children sitting in the markets and calling unto their fellows and saying, 'We have piped unto you, and you have not danced. We have mourned unto you, and you have not lamented.'" These children wondered why, when the aulos, the Greek flute, had piped, why no one was moved to dance. A parallel account of this can be found in Luke 7, verse 32. Another reference to music and dancing in Jesus' day comes in his parable of the prodigal son in Luke 15. The celebration for the son's return included music and dancing, verse 25. The Greek word for music is symphonia, meaning musicians playing together. Here we have not only secular music, but ensemble music, and the word for dancing, choros, additionally implies singing and dancing. This particular Greek word for dancing is used only here in the New Testament. The other references to dancing in the New Testament testify to the power of this art form, but this power is cast in a negative light as it refers to the dance of Herodias' daughter at Herod's birthday party, a dance that caused Herod to offer her anything she wanted, a request that ended in the beheading of John the Baptist. Going back to the Old Testament, this portion of the scriptural record also documents prophecies of a time that has no historical fulfillment, a time that some believe lies yet ahead. These beautiful forecasts include a renaissance in the art of dance, again, which implies something similar with the art of music. A time is coming, Isaiah 35 verse 5 states, where the lame will leap as a hart and the tongue of the dumb sing. Not only is this another connection in the biblical record between singing and dancing, but one referring to a time of great healing that will include these art forms. A verse in Zechariah 8 says that boys and girls will be playing in the streets of Jerusalem during an unprecedented time of coming peace. The word for playing can refer either to instrumental music or dancing. And Zephaniah 3 shows the catalyst of this unprecedented time of coming peace will be the result of the presence of God himself. Verses 14 and 17 of that chapter read, "Sing, O daughter of Zion, shout, O Israel, be glad and rejoice with all the heart, O daughter of Jerusalem. The Lord your God in the midst of you is mighty. He will save. He will rejoice over you with joy. He will rest in his love. He will joy over you with singing." This verse refers to God's singing voice, but what's more, the phrase, "He will joy over you," can refer to movement of trembling or circling. Zephaniah's prophecy indicates God's divine presence as setting the standard for this new age in song and dance. This has been Sounds of Scripture. You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today's episode is titled Moving Music, and in it we are exploring music inspired by the art of dance. Now, instead of going through history in chronological order like we usually do, Baroque era, classical era, romantic era, modern era, I want to approach this show differently. I basically have four categories of ways that dance has impacted the standard repertoire, and I want to explore music through each of these four categories. The first three categories are pieces that were intended to be listened to and not necessarily danced to, and the fourth category would be music intended to be danced to. So the first category I've identified is compositions which are intended to be heard, not necessarily danced to, but their structure was inspired by specific dances. These dances on which the composers base this music would dictate the meter of the piece, the rhythmic qualities of it, and perhaps even the number of measures per phrase. We've talked about some of this in previous episodes, and we'll talk about several more today. The second category in this discussion is similar to the first, music intended to be heard, not necessarily danced to, but was programmatic, meaning it was to depict a story or a scene where dancing is occurring. We'll hear some great examples of this. The third category I've identified, where the art of dance has impacted the musical repertoire, is another kind of music that was, again, intended to be heard, not necessarily danced to, but it's vocal music where the text is about dancing, and so the music usually follows suit to illustrate this dance-like quality. The fourth category in this discussion is the most obvious, music intended to be danced to in a staged production, either as a segment of an opera or play, or as an entire production intended to be danced to, that is, a ballet. So let's explore that first category. Music intended to be heard, not danced to, but its structure was inspired by specific dances. The dances upon which the composers based this music would dictate the meter, the stress pattern of the beat. It would determine the rhythmic qualities of the piece, you know, whether there was a pickup note or a couple pickup notes, and perhaps it would even dictate the number of measures per phrase. We talked a fair bit about these in two previous episodes, one on the folk element and one on the Celtic influence in music history. Folk dances like gavottes, berets, jigs, hornpipes, polonaises, minuets, and mazurkas have been the structural and rhythmic framework for a number of pieces from the Baroque era through the present. For the sake of time, I'm not going to play any of these, but you can go back to the folk element and the Celtic influence episodes in our archives to hear examples of some of these short movements, which are commonly heard in Baroque suites. A couple of dances that I did not mention in those episodes, though, are the waltz, which I have played a Chopin waltz in another episode, and the contradance, an English country dance. There are pieces from the classical era simply called Deutscher Tanz, or German dance, sometimes referred to as a peasant dance, which is similar to the minuet or the waltz. Another dance, a slower 3-beat-per-bar dance from the Austrian folk culture, is the Ländler, L-A-Umlaut, N-D-L-E-R. These were common dances incorporated into the music of the late 18th century, also known as the classical era. But we also see these dances inspiring compositions late into the Romantic era. In the early 1900s, Gustav Mahler completed his 9th and final symphony. The second movement is titled Im Tempo eines gemächlichen Ländlers etwas täppisch und sehr derb. That's quite a movement title. And it means, in the leisurely tempo of a Ländler, somewhat clumsy and very coarse. So let's hear a portion of this Ländler movement of Mahler's 9th symphony. Here it is, performed by conductor Pierre Boulez with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. Thank you. So we are discussing concert music inspired by specific dances, meaning these pieces had a rhythmic structure based on or patterned after a specific dance. And that was just a portion of the second movement of Gustav Mahler's Ninth Symphony, which the composer indicated was patterned after the Austrian folk dance, the Ländler. We heard it performed by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra under the baton of Pierre Boulez. We know of many pieces patterned after the waltz, the gavotte, the jig, the polonaise, the minuet, and many other types of common dances. Oftentimes, these dances were grouped together in multi-movement works known as suites. This was common in the Baroque era, but even when we move into the early 20th century, we see composers like Claude Debussy still writing suites, mostly for the piano, and they are, like their Baroque predecessors, patterned after dances. His suite titled For the Piano has a second movement titled Sarabande, just like the commonly used Sarabande in Baroque suites. We see the dance influence in the third and fourth movement of Debussy's Petite Suite. The third movement is called Minuet, and the fourth movement simply Ballet. Let's listen to a little bit of the four-hand version of this piano suite. That means four hands of two people on one piano. Here are pianists Lee Luvisi and Anne-Marie McDermott. So that was the ballet movement, a concert work and instrumental piece intended to be heard, not for a ballet. We heard pianists Lee Luvisi and Anne-Marie McDermott, and you could hear the dance-like meter of the music. And right now in our program, Moving Music, we are exploring concert music inspired by the art of dance. In this episode and in past episodes, we've seen specific dances being the framework for certain compositions, and we know this because the composer usually titles the piece of music after the kind of dance. Another dance that had a big impact on the musical repertoire was a dance that apparently had to be danced to when you were bitten by a wolf spider common to the Taranto province of Italy. The spider was known as the tarantula, and the dance the tarantella. I've heard that you would dance the tarantella either to rid your body of the supposed poison from the bite, or the poison was believed to cause hysteria that brought about such a lively dance. Either way, it's usually a quick 6-8 time. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Let's hear a showy violin piece. Because of its quick nature, if you ever see a tarantella on a concert program, you can pretty much be guaranteed a showstopper. This is Nathan Milstein performing Pablo de Sarasate's Introduction and Tarantella, and I suspect you'll be able to know when the introduction ends and the tarantella begins. Thank you. That was Introduction and Tarantella for Violin and Piano, performed by violinist Nathan Milstein from his recording The Last Recital. A tarantella is a lively dance and apparently what you were supposed to do when bitten by a tarantula. And tarantellas are always quite showy pieces. Usually movements or pieces that are patterned after this dance have that in the title. But it's not always the case, as the tarantella rhythm is a pretty distinct one, so you can usually spot it even if the composer doesn't explicitly write it in the title. That's the case in the fourth movement of Franz Schubert's String Quartet No. 14 in D minor. The string quartet is nicknamed Death and the Maiden. Here's a little of that fourth movement, and the tarantella rhythm is unmistakable. Here it is performed by the Emerson String Quartet. Another dance that composers also drew inspiration from was the habanera. Habanera is a Spanish word meaning from Havana, and it often refers to a Cuban folk dance. Maurice Ravel, a contemporary of Claude Debussy, wrote a vocalise in the form of a habanera. A vocalise usually is a melody with accompaniment, and the melody can be sung or played really by any single line instrument like a flute or an oboe. And you hear the habanera rhythm from the piano right away in this example. Here's a recording of a clarinetist doing it, Elizabeth Gonter and pianist Peter Schmalfuss. So that was a little of Ravel's piece, In the Form of a Habanera, using the rhythmic framework of a folk dance from the Hispanic culture. The most famous habanera written is a vocal work in the opera Carmen by Georges Bizet. It's an opera set in Spain, so the title character's most famous aria is rhythmically set up as a habanera, even though the text has nothing to do with dancing. We'll hear a little bit of this recording of Agnes Balza with the Berlin Philharmonic under Herbert von Karajan.
Si je t'aime, si je t'aime, si je t'aime.
So that was the famous aria from Georges Bizet's Carmen, sung by the title character. It's a vocal work patterned after the Cuban dance known as the habanera. We heard it performed in that recording by Agnes Balza with the Berlin Philharmonic under Herbert von Karajan. So we've been exploring concert music that wasn't intended to be danced to, but it was inspired by a specific dance or the art of dance in general. This was common back in the Baroque era, with instrumental suites being comprised of various dances from across Europe, and we talked about that quite a bit in previous episodes of this program, one on the folk element and one on the Celtic influence. In the folk element episode, I mentioned Brahms's Hungarian dances and Dvorak's Slavonic dances, which we don't need to hear an example of here, but I should also mention in this context that along the same lines would be Sergei Rachmaninoff's symphonic dances, which pull from Russian folk elements, and Rimsky-Korsakov's Capriccio Español, which is a suite based on Spanish folk dances. And since we've just heard some habaneras, let's stay in the Hispanic flavor and hear some of Rimsky-Korsakov's finale to his Capriccio Español suite. This movement, as its title indicates, is a Spanish folk dance known as the fandango. We're hearing the Philadelphia Orchestra under Eugene Normandy. You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. In today's episode, titled Moving Music, we are showing the impact the art of dance has had on music history. We are doing this by discussing four types of compositions. The first category we just discussed was concert music inspired by a specific kind of dance meter, but purely to be heard, not necessarily to be danced to itself. That was the fandango, the finale of Rimsky-Korsakov's Capriccio Español suite, and that was Eugene Normandy conducting the Philadelphia Orchestra. The second category in our discussion today is music intended to be heard, not really intended to be danced to, that was programmatic. This means it was to depict a story or a scene where dancing is occurring. Again, this isn't a staged dance, but the music is calling on the imagination to create scenes of dancing. An example of this is a piece by cellist and Romantic-era composer David Popper. His piece Nomentanz, or Dance of the Gnomes, creates this scene of these little fictional characters dancing. Here's a recording of cellist Janos Starker and pianist Shigeo Neriki. That was cellist Janos Starker performing David Popper's Gnomentanz, or Dance of the Gnomes. We are talking about programmatic music, that is, music intended to depict something non-musical, usually a scene. And since we're talking about the influence of the art of dance on the musical repertoire, we are currently discussing programmatic music which has the theme of dancing. That is, it's intended to depict a story or scene where dancing is occurring. That was a fun example of some fictional gnomes dancing. Along the same lines, I think of Camille Saint-Saëns' Danse Macabre, an orchestral piece known as a tone poem, which in this case is supposed to depict skeletons dancing. Now, skeletons may not be the best reference in a show called Music for Life, but it's actually quite a well-known and lively, fun piece of music, and I would be remiss not to mention it in this context. Here's a little bit of the dancing music that you hear in it until it's interrupted by the morning's rooster crow. This is the National Philharmonic Orchestra with Leopold Stokowski. So that was a portion of Saint-Saëns' Danse Macabre, an orchestral piece which is supposed to evoke images of dancing, in this case dancing skeletons, and it's a famous example of a programmatic piece of music about dancing, that is, it's intended to depict a story or scene where dancing is occurring. To find another example of this, we can go back to Claude Debussy, who wrote a 6-movement piano suite based on different toys of his 3-year-old daughter. One toy was a black doll called a Gollywog, and the final movement of the suite was programmatic of this toy called Gollywog's Cakewalk. So this is a piece of music to depict this particular toy dancing a cakewalk, which has similar syncopations to the ragtime music of the turn of the 20th century. Here it is performed by pianist Jean-Bernard Pommier. You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today's episode is titled Moving Music, and in it we are exploring music inspired by the art of dance. We are doing this by discussing 4 types of compositions. The first category we explored was concert music inspired by a specific kind of dance meter, but purely to be heard, not necessarily to be danced to itself. The second category we just discussed was concert music that was programmatic, meaning it was intended to depict a scene or story with dancing in it, but not necessarily to be danced to itself. That was Gollywog's Cakewalk by Claude Debussy, performed by Jean-Bernard Pommier, where it's meant to depict an imaginary dance by this toy doll. In our third category, let's explore some vocal music which contains text about dancing, in which cases most composers gave a dance-like quality to the music. In the Baroque era, which has so much music based on dances and dance-like rhythms, we have a vocal work that refers specifically to dancing. It's based on this verse by John Milton, "Come and trip it as ye go on the light fantastic toe." And from this, we get the English cliché, trip the light fantastic, which refers to dancing in a light, nimble manner. George Frideric Handel set this phrase in a choral orchestral work he composed that set two of Milton's poems, L'Allegro and Il Penseroso. By translation, one poem representing the joyful man and the other the contemplative man. Here's a recording by the English Baroque soloists and Monteverdi Choir conducted by John Elliott Gardiner. They are performing this exact phrase from Milton's text, and you can hear the dance-like quality in the musical setting of this text. That was Come and Trip It from Handel's choral orchestral work, known as a pastoral ode. It was based on a poem of John Milton's which refers to dancing through the poetic idea of tripping on the light fantastic toe. That was a recording by the English Baroque soloists and Monteverdi Choir, conducted by John Elliott Gardiner. Handel's music perfectly suited the subject of dancing in the text. And in this part of the show, we are exploring vocal music which contains text about dancing, causing the composers to create a dance-like quality in the music. Here is a song for four voices by Franz Schubert. Usually it's performed by a four-part chorus, but here's a recording of a quartet of four famous singers, Ellie Ameling, soprano, Janet Baker, mezzo-soprano, Peter Schreyer, tenor, Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau, baritone. They are performing with pianist Gerald Moore, and this is Schubert's Der Tanz, or The Dance. And it's a song about dancing, so you can hear the strong dance-like meter, perhaps you hear a waltz, in this piece.
Bald schmerzet die Brust, verschwunden ist alle die himmlische Lust. Nur diesmal noch kehrt ihr Gesundheit zurück, so flehe vom Himmel der hoffende Blick. Nur diesmal noch kehrt ihr Gesundheit zurück, so flehe vom Himmel der hoffende Blick.
That was a short four-voice song by Franz Schubert about dancing called Der Tanz, or The Dance, and you could hear the waltz-like quality in the music. One of the many songs composed by Johannes Brahms is one about a boy leading a girl to a dance. This is Brauner Bursche führt zum Tanze, and the song about the Tanze, or the dance, refers specifically to a csárdás being played, which is a traditional Hungarian folk dance. Hear the folk dance-like quality in this short song. Here it is sung by Waltraud Meyer. The pianist is Gerhard Opitz.
Schönes Kind schlägt die Sporen keck zusammen, charisch Melodie beginnt. Küsst und Herz ein süßes Teufel.
That was a song by Johannes Brahms, which has text referring to a boy and girl dancing a csárdás, a Hungarian folk dance. It was sung by Valtraud Meyer. Again, in this portion of our episode, we are exploring vocal music which contains text about dancing and therefore a dance-like quality in the music itself. To close out this discussion, let's hear a duet from Engelbert Humperdinck's opera Hansel and Gretel. This is where Gretel is trying to teach her brother how to dance, and you can hear the lilting dance meter in the music that Humperdinck composes. This is soprano Edita Gruberova as Gretel and mezzo-soprano Anne Murray as Hansel. If you recall from a previous episode, Hansel is a pants role sung by a mezzo-soprano. The lower female voice in operas of this day could depict a main character who was a young boy. Here is the duo singing about dancing to dance-like music.
Ich bin der schwarze Hans. Mit kleinen Mädchen tanz ich nicht, das ist mir viel zu dumm. Der stolze Hans, der dumme Hans, ich krieg dich noch herum. Tralala, lalala, lalala, tralala, lalala, lalala. Dreh dich herum, mein lieber Hans, lalala, lalala, mein lieber Hans. Ach, Schwesterlein, ach, Gretelein, du hast im Strumpf ein Loch. Ach, Gretelein,
listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. In today's episode, titled Moving Music, we are exploring the impact the art of dance has had on music history. We are doing this by discussing four types of compositions. We've talked about, number one, concert music inspired by a specific kind of dance meter. Number two, concert music that was programmatic, that is, meant to depict a scene or story with dancing in it, but not necessarily to be danced to itself. And number three, vocal music, which contains text about dancing, which inspired the composers to give a dance-like quality to the music. And the duet we just heard was a great example of that, one of the opening scenes of Hansel and Gretel, where the sister is trying to encourage her brother to dance with her. When we come back, we will get into our fourth category of this historical discussion, where the art of dance has impacted the musical repertoire, and this category is the most obvious, that is, music intended to be danced to in a staged production, either as a segment of an opera or play where the characters would dance, or a dance break would represent some element of the story, or as an entire production, like a ballet, intended to be danced to. We will also have our Classroom Corner segment where we discuss the benefits of movement in the classroom, as well as a delicious example with which to end our show, our dessert for today, you won't want to miss. We'll be right back.